Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of very special Empire podcasts entitled The Ranking, wherein four Empire writers take a filmography, could be a series, could be a director, could be a writer, could even be an actor, could be a franchise, who knows? And we argue the toss over the top 10. What's good? What's bad? What's up? What's down? And this week we are talking about the filmography of one Sir Ridley Scott, Ridders himself. Ridders me this, Ridders me that. What's in your top 10? And joining me to discuss Sir Ridley and his output, placing his phone very gingerly on the table, is James Dyer.
Hello.
How are you?
I've seen films you people wouldn't believe.
that's from
Alien.
White Squall, yeah. Dan Jolin is also here.
Hello. Are you not entertained?
Not
good.
No.
Blade Runner, like it.
Yeah.
Palpably, they're not so far. And last but certainly least is Nick Dissemblian.
I'm good, Chris. Thank you. Hang on. No, wait. There's something in my stomach. My stomach is getting.
Oh no!
Oh
no!
No, it was just the Wagamama I had. It's fine. Carry on.
What did you have?
I had. I was going to have a chicken katsu, but I had some noodle leafing instead.
Yes, I.
Thanks for asking.
Yes, I yakisoba.
That's good. It's good. That's my favourite.
Yeah. Is that vegetarian?
Yeah.
Yes,
you
it
hate
is.
It.
Yeah, they eat it in Blade Runner.
It has not yet burst out of my stomach.
All right, so we're here to talk about the films of Sir Ridley Scott, which is a dangerous enterprise because, quite frankly, the man is so prolific, he could make another two or three in the time it takes us to record this podcast. We're tying this to the release of his most recent film, All the Money in the World, which came out the same year as Alien Covenant. And if you look at the guy's filmography, he's been really stepping it up over the last few years. He's making a film a year, pretty much, over the last 5 years, The Martian and The Counselor and Prometheus and All that good stuff. Should we start off by talking about, the standard ranking stuff, when we first got in to Sir Ridders? Do you remember the first Ridley Scott film that you saw? James?
I was on set of Alien, so that was the first Ridley Scott film I saw.
What?
I can't believe in the, whatever it is, 18 years I've known you, I've not told you I was on set of Alien.
How old are you?
I'm very, very old.
Are you like...
I have absolutely no memory of it. I was far too young. And obviously it was actually weird that my mum would take me on to... I don't think she knew what it was, to be honest, at the time. But she took me on the set. And the only thing I remember is they had a big production book which had a lot of the art and the costumes and the production stuff in it. And that hung around my mum's office for ages afterwards. So the first memory I have is seeing that book and being traumatized by it. I don't remember actually being on the set. My mum told me there were lots of mirrors. That's how they made the long corridors of the ship. It was like 10 feet long and they just had mirrors.
Mother.
There you go.
Wow, was there any smoke as well?
There could have been smoke.
Okay.
Smoke and mirrors both. But yes, that was my entry point to Sir Ridders.
When was the first time you saw Ridders?
It definitely wasn't Alien.
You lie and sign yourself to lies.
Yes, I have. Legend. I saw Legend in the cinema. So that was probably it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember I saw that in Swiss Cottage, I think, at the Odeon.
That's the first one you were on set of as well. That's a hell of a story. I was on set of a film, but I can't remember anything about it. Dan, I'm sure you've had a few of those. Have you been on set of a Sir Ridder's joint?
I've never been on the set of a Sir Ridley Scott movie. No, I haven't, actually.
Thanks, Dan. Nick Dissemblian, have you been on the set of a Sir Ridley Scott film?
I've not been on the set of a Ridley Scott film. I wish that I'd been on set of Black Rain as a 9-year-old. I would have... absolutely love that, but sadly not.
Watching Andy Garcia get us. I want to know how they did that.
Movie magic.
That's the magic of the movies.
Smoke and mirrors.
No, yeah. It's Black Rain. What was the first Ridley Scott film that you saw, Dan Forth?
Oh, it was Alien, but not all of it.
How old were you?
Well, this is the thing. So for me as a kid, Alien was the Holy Grail, right? That was the film I wanted to see more than any other film, but I wasn't allowed because I was obviously too young. But I know I was also a bit scared of it. I kind of knew, but I got my mum to tell me the whole plot of the film. So I'd already seen Alien in my head before I saw Alien. And I was going like, Mum, what's the alien look like? What's the alien look like? And she's like, well, it's got a long head.
It's like
and,
a cock, Dad. Yeah.
It's got a long head and it's got two mouths. So in my head, the alien looked like a kind of like Chewbacca, but with an egg for a head with two mouths in it. So that's what I thought like he was going to look like.
Yeah.
But I knew the whole story about the bursting out of the stomach and everything, spoiler. And in the end, I plucked up the courage, and they had it on VHS. We had a top loader VHS player. I plucked up the courage to start watching it.
What age were you?
Oh, crikey. I think I must have been about 8.
Okay.
And my mum and dad let me because, I don't know, they're weird and mad. And started watching it. and this is great, this is great. And then they're all at the dinner table, right? And they're all sitting around the dinner table. And then, and this is completely true, front doorbell rang, a man came in and took the video player, took video player away.
What like a man your dad owed money to or something?
Possibly. I don't know the story of why, but I just remember sitting there going, what? And we didn't have a video player anymore. And it was just before the chestburster scene. And then I didn't actually see Alien all the way through until after I'd seen Aliens as a teenager. So it was like another 6 years before I finally actually got to see Alien.
So did you think the film just ended with a nice meal and then they just go back?
No, because I knew what was going to happen because I already had the whole film right. in my head because my mum had told me.
You thought Chewbacca with an egg on his head was going to...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, no, by this point, I did know what the alien looked like because one of the kids in my school had a toy xenomorph, which I swapped one of my toys with him to get it, and it was the most brilliant toy.
What did you swap?
I can't remember. Do you know what? I know what it was. It was one of those little computers, like a Mr. Maths.
Like Speak and Spell type. Yeah,
but it was a little thing. It had a little guy with a kind of...
The Professor. Yeah.
That was it. So I swapped the Professor for the alien, and my mum was so pissed off at me because I swapped an educational toy for a monster.
You're listening to I Love the 1980s, a very special episode of the Empire Podcast.
I want to hear the director's cut of that story because that already felt endless.
Sorry. But no, Alien has always been huge in my life. It's there. It's in my DNA, but not in a shit way like Prometheus.
That story was Dan's Kingdom of Heaven.
Arise a night.
Is that what the Queen said to Ridley Scott when she knighted him?
Arise. And night.
Oh, you think she
and
was
he
just?
Said, I
you
am
think
Jerusalem.
She was? The Queen was actually just a massive fan of Kingdom of Heaven, and
she was
like, it was just a misunderstanding, and he thought he was being knighted.
Who isn't?
I prefer the director's cut myself. It's a masterpiece.
That's the Queen, by the way.
Oh, right.
In case you weren't sure who that was.
Sorry, I thought that was Edward Norton.
One for the much enjoys. One
Nicholas, what was your entry point to
I
Ritter's?
I hate to disappoint. I don't have a strong memory of seeing one of these for the first time. It was kind of Alien was a bit overshadowed by Aliens for me because I saw Aliens first. And that was on a VHS tape that was getting passed around my school. And that blew my mind. And so I think seeing Alien after that, it didn't quite, you know, I always thought that was a kind of a lesser thing. And it's only since then that I've, you know, obviously come to understand how brilliant the film it is.
I've come to see its majesty.
It is amazing.
We saw it recently, didn't we? Was it three of us? Or,
yep.
You know, sorry, Dan.
There's four of us in the room.
I know, but I'm ignoring you for the purposes of the anecdote because you weren't there. You must have fallen off the WhatsApp group notifications because you don't check your phone, do you, Dan?
Well, you know, I'm trying to reduce my screen
time. Oh, no, wait.
Chris.
I know what it was. We didn't invite you. So there was... I'm kidding, Dan. I love you. Did we see it?
Yeah, we did.
70 mil?
We saw a furry...
The celluloid.
It was like an original print.
Yeah, 70 mil print. We saw it
and
in the...
And it was kind of a bit purple and moved a lot. Looked like an alien was in the projection booth.
Are you talking about... Oh, the alien, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
It was.
But I think, yeah, when you were a teenager, I think Aliens kind of hits you in the between the ears. And the first film, seeing it on the big screen, that was actually the first time I'd seen it on the big screen when I saw it with you guys. And I think that's the ideal way to see it. It's slow and creeping dread and all that.
It's kind of amazing watching Alien and Aliens back because they take their sweet time. I know it's about an hour into Aliens before we even see an alien. And the same thing with Alien. It's about 45 minutes or so before John Hurt needs some Rennies. And that's incredible. You can't imagine that happening these days. I mean, even 10 years ago, I remember interviewing Paul W.S. Anderson about Alien versus Predator when he was shooting on set. And I did a phoner with him from the set. And I said the same thing. It's like, you know, Predator takes its sweet time getting to the Predator. Alien takes its sweet time getting to the Alien. What about you? Are you going to do the same thing? He goes, yeah, of course. We're going to have a slow build-up. And you watch that movie, there's a Predator in the first shot. There's an alien in like the second shot. It's just...
Well, maybe by slow build-up, he meant the studio logo. And then...
Enough of that.
Yeah. Jurassic Park, you don't see the T-Rex for an hour either. So, similar
and
thing.
Then, yeah. Although you do see Bob Peck right away.
The Unleashed Peck early on.
But I think that's really interesting in terms of Ridley's slow burn approach to his movies all the way through his career. I mean, even if you look at Prometheus and Alien Covenant, and they cut to the chase a lot earlier than Alien did.
It doesn't apply to all his films. I mean, you see Hannibal quite early on in Hannibal. You see Robin Hood quite early on in Robin Hood. There's matchstick men everywhere in the first frame of Thelma and Louise.
Oh, it's good. It's good.
You don't see a Martian at all. I'm pretty annoyed at that.
Yeah, right? It's just humans.
It's just a man.
Yeah. Rubbish.
Lol. I think I'm like you guys as well, though. I think I saw Alien first, or Blade Runner, one of the two, when I was just a bairn and my parents didn't care what I watched.
None of you saw Legend? That surprises me.
No, I did. Legend was a big film of my childhood as well. I've seen Legend probably more than any other Ridley Scott film apart from Blade Runner and Alien.
Is it on your list? Is it in your top 10, Dan?
It is in my top 10, actually.
Holy cow. Don't tell us what your top 10 is yet. We'll do that at the end of the show.
I wasn't going to.
Legend, yeah, I saw Legend. Definitely saw Legend. But the chestburster scene had infamy on its side, didn't it? So I was aware of the chestburster sequence even before I saw it. I'm pretty sure I saw it on TV late at night before. And I wasn't really aware of the film, and I certainly wasn't aware of Ridley Scott, but I saw the chestburster sequence, and I was like, wow, that's pretty cool.
I think I might have seen Spaceballs and its spoof of that scene before I saw the actual scene.
Really?
Yeah. It is slightly better than the Spaceballs version, but there's not much in it.
There's less dancing.
Yeah.
So, there is. One of the things you often hear said about Ridley Scott is that for a man of his magnificence and his prolificness, he hasn't made that many stone-cold classics. And that may be slightly controversial, but what I mean is he made Alien, which is undeniably a classic, as his second film. The Duelists, I think we can all agree, is flawed, but not a classic. And then he made Blade Runner. And then he had a bit of a fallow period. Thelma and Louise, you could argue, is a classic. A lot of people will be rooting for Gladiator. Not a film I love. We'll talk about Kingdom of Heaven in a second. I feel that might be slightly controversial as well. And then you come up to The Martian. So in this long, storied career of his, has he really only hit the jackpot 2, 3, 4 times? And is that enough to put him into the pantheon?
Well, it's really interesting because I'm not going to give anything away, but my top 5 is one film per decade. So
then it's immediately wrong.
So according to me, according to this list I've put together, he makes one great movie a decade. That's his hit rate.
But that's a good thing, right? Because that means that at least once a decade. I mean, he's in his 80s now, and he's still firing away. He's working on a movie right now. I think he has plans to shoot something else after that. He may even do another Alien, who knows. And he's the busiest man in Hollywood. Yeah, he has peaks and troughs, shall we say, as illustrated by last year, where he made Alien Covenant, which I think is a terrible film, and All the Money in the World, which isn't a great film, but it's a good film. Mm. But he's also made The Martian recently, so he can still knock it out of the park in his late 70s and early 80s, when most people will be falling asleep drooling in front of Countdown.
I mean, the thing I found with Ridley Scott is you can always guarantee it will be a visual feast, as the critics say. You can it's always going to look good, and he's always at his best when he's world building, you know, whether that's historically or fantastically. But and I'm going to actually quote Ian Nathan here. He's got a tin ear when it comes to script. He doesn't seem to have quality control button when it comes to scripts, to storytelling. So, which means you get really good looking films, but they're just a mess story wise.
He's a very visual director. It's funny, like I interviewed him for The Martian, and while he was talking to me, he was doing an oil painting. Like he was painting. He goes, "Well, as I'm talking to you, I'm painting a picture."
Was he painting you?
He and could, was it well. Nude? He was painting me like one of his French girls. Was saying it's like he's very, very visual. Everything with him, like he pictures. Like he, when he sees a script, I think he sees the visuals of, and that's his entry point to any project he goes into. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, I think the story is a little bit secondary. I think it's all about, you know, how it's going to appear on screen.
Yeah, Thelma and Louise is maybe one of the exceptions where it's not so much about the visuals, perhaps, and more about the story and the characters.
I disagree. I think Thelma and Louise is very visually powerful. I mean, the using that American, almost classically Western landscape as the backdrop for that is a very big film. And it's an intimate story. But it's a huge film, and that's why it's so good, I think. And I think you need that. I think that's what makes it really work.
Yeah, and I guess the most iconic moment in that film is a visual moment.
Very much so.
With the driving off the cliff at the end. Spoiler alert.
No, Brad Pitt was shut off.
Oh, hello.
Yes, the driving off the cliff.
Baby Brad.
Yeah, but yeah, I think you're right. The Duelist is a very visual film. Alien, obviously, I mean, he comes from this advertising background. He comes from this art school background, which really plays into a lot of his movies. Blade Runner looks stunning. Legend, Someone to Watch Over Me. Even a sort of mid-level thriller like Someone to Watch Over Me has some really lovely visuals going for it. Black Rain is suffused in steam and fog and mist and is utterly daft.
It's a two-hour lager commercial, but it's...
isn't it?
It looks amazing. I rewatched that over the weekend and it's not a good film, script-wise or character-wise. Michael Douglas doing his ultimate sort of bad boy cop thing that he did in Basic Instinct a couple of years later. But, you know, it looks great. There's some amazing shots. And there's so much neon. Like, there could not be any more neon in that film.
It's Michael Douglas's best hair, would you say?
Very good hair.
It's really good hair.
Very good hair.
And Andy Garcia has good hair on top of it.
For a while.
Yeah. For a while. Looking back at some of the stuff he's done recently, Black Hawk Down, Hannibal, which is a film that, you know, it suffers in comparison, as indeed does Prometheus and Alien Covenant, to the fact that it's being compared to one of the greatest films of all time. But I kind of really enjoyed Hannibal. It has a lot of good, it has a lot of good stuff going for it. It's got a sense of fun. It's got his tongue rammed into someone else's cheek.
In many ways, the worst Hannibal film, and I include Young Hannibal.
Young Hannibal, is that like Young Sheldon?
Yes.
It's not the worst Hannibal film. It is absolutely not the worst Hannibal
film. Silence is great. Red Dragon is decent. Yeah. And then
Dragon is absolutely workmanlike, whereas Hannibal has some really, really fun sequences.
It's got Gary Oldman attempting the Winston Churchill makeup for the first time. It didn't quite work. Didn't get him the Oscar that time, but they nailed it later on.
We all like to see Ray Liotta's brain being eaten with a spoon.
Who doesn't love that?
Well, look, Red Dragon is workmanlike. Absolutely agree, which makes it watchable. Hannibal is like... This weirdly, like I say, it looks great, but it's just shit.
It's a pure exercise in style.
It's a baroque piece of shit.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with being a piece of shit. Ridley polishes that turd and then some.
And it was not a good book. The stuff with pigs just about works on the page, but it does not work on the screen.
No, I'm talking about the really interesting stuff in Florence with Giancarlo Giannini, who's really fun, and that sequence is really over the top. That's fun, guys. Where's your sense of fun? It's one thing that we look at, you know, look at Ritter's filmography as perhaps is lacking is a sense of fun. Alien is not a laugh fest. Blade Runner is not a laugh fest, but he actually has quite a mordant sense of humor.
The Martian is maybe his funniest film.
Matchstick Man has some fun as well.
Yeah.
Both of which are on my list. I mean, I quite like that playful side of him. The Martian is a really, really commercial movie. But I'm just saying, give Hannibal a little bit more love.
It's Hannibal's.
It is.
Hannibal's.
Feed it to the pigs, Errol.
All right. Well, if you like that controversial opinion, I've got another one for you as well. Blade Runner ain't all that.
Oh God.
Okay. You. I didn't want to do this, Chris, but with that, you have forced me to out you as a man who didn't understand the plot of Blade Runner. A man who, until recently, believed the replicants were robots.
I still don't get it. They clearly have some sort of programming. How are they not robots?
They are artificially created organic life forms. Do not have, like, circuit boards and
How do they have programming?
How do they have programming?
Yeah.
I didn't make them. I don't work for Tyrell Corporation.
You're standing in very thin ice there, matey.
Psychological programming. That's the whole point of the dreams and the memories. They insert the memories and they create the dreams for them.
How do they insert the memories, Dan?
With the memory-making machine.
Yeah.
How are they super strong, Dan?
Well, next you can be asking me how they go into people's dreams in Inception. It doesn't matter.
How do they go into people's dreams in Inception,
Dan? It's pretty clear they use that one wire and the other one. You can get them in Maplins, or you could.
It's an HDMI cable.
RIP, Maplins.
Oh, man.
No, Blade Runner is brilliant, and you're a Burke.
Well, I stand corrected.
What don't you like about it?
It's long, boring, dull, and doesn't go anywhere.
Time to die.
Let's get to heaven.
We'll get on to that in a second.
There are some elements of Blade Runner that don't stand up, so you know there's some quite... horrible sexual abuse going on in it. So
dodgy sexual politics.
It's on my list,
but that's because, you know, it's not as bad as Exodus: Gods and Kings or The Counselor.
Chris, all of your opinions will be lost in time like tears in rain. But you are right. Exodus, Gods and Kings is a shocking film.
Yeah.
That's the Counselor. I mean, is the Counselor bad? It's very average. It's relentlessly bleak.
Some people think it's a masterpiece.
I'd say it's anything but average. It's a weird film.
No,
it's
weird film. I think it is quite average.
It's got Cameron
Diaz
having sex with a car.
And
it's got, it's got the one of the best screen deaths in, I'd say, the last 10 years.
Oh, what, with the collar thing?
Bandolera.
Yes.
With the exploding thing that wraps around your neck.
So that was crazy. It's so bleak. Like, I came out of that film feeling like I did at the end of The Mist.
It's staying true to Cormac McCarthy, whose stuff is pretty bleak and nihilistic for the most part.
Yeah.
I thought it was an interesting film.
The great lost Ridley Scott film for me is actually Blood Meridian, which he was working on for ages and was going to be an adaptation of that great Cormac McCarthy book. And I could just absolutely see that working with Ridley Scott. I mean, this sort of blood-soaked grand Western, it would have been awesome. Even more so than his version of I Am Legend with Arnold Schwarzenegger. But yeah, I get that. I absolutely get that. It, you know, it chimes with McCarthy's themes, but it's just not very good, is it?
No, it's
a bit ponderous and pretentious. But again, people will go to bat for it and say it's a masterpiece. And what do I know? I quite like bits of Hannibal.
Well, what are we saying is Ridder's worst film? Are we saying it's Exodus? Are we saying it's G.I. Jane? Where do we think is the bottom of the barrel, Dan?
Alien Covenant.
Really?
Yep.
No.
Yep.
I mean, it's not good, but it's not the worst.
Hated it.
If I had to choose between Exodus, all 17 hours of it, and Alien Covenant,
I'd watch Exodus over Alien.
I'd take the Alien over Moses pretty much every day of the week.
Exodus had one good idea in it. Alien Covenant has none.
Alien Covenant is an objectively not good film, but you know, I could watch it again if only for the fingering scene.
James, let me do the fingering. Covenant weirdly almost made it onto my list because I liked the ending so much. It was one of the films of last year where I walked out of going, I didn't think the film overall was great, but I thought the last 5-10 minutes, even though I saw it coming, I thought that is a ballsy ending to put in.
This was an interesting one as well. Like that, it's a film with a twist which is telegraphed so horrifically. Like I don't understand how that got through.
But the twist is telegraphed, but the ending isn't. You don't go into that thinking that David is going to win.
The level of bleakness.
No, I thought there was going to be a final confrontation on board, and that she was going to get the upper hand. But I didn't see coming just how dark and horrendous and nihilistic. Yeah. It felt like a real 70s ending in a way.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, fair play to him. He's gone for it.
Yeah, it's the ending that Alien itself doesn't have. Even Prometheus has a slightly hopeful ending.
Yeah.
And hopeful for me in that it ended, which was good.
I've got a soft spot for Prometheus.
I
rather enjoyed that when it came out.
I don't mind the first hour of Prometheus.
I mean, Prometheus is The Phantom Menace and Alien Covenant is Attack of the Clones. I mean, this is, you know, all we can hope is that if he does do another one, it'll be half as good as Revenge of the Sith.
I think Prometheus works as a standalone piece of hard sci-fi. I don't think it works as part of the Alien verse. And in my head, I detach the two things. Like I try and take it as its own thing. And I think if Covenant had also been something that felt separate, I would have enjoyed that more. But when it started treading on holy alien ground, I can't believe
it has some of the stupidest character behavior. Just like, yes, I'm just going to stand next to this giant pulsating egg thing that is next to some dead bodies. And what could possibly go wrong? But, you know, I kind of admire that there is some risk-taking going on in those two films. So I don't completely hate them.
You look at his films over the last few years, it's kind of interesting because Prometheus and Alien Covenant, for me, are about disproving that God exists and essentially saying that we were created by a different alien race. I'm not entirely sure that Ridley Scott is saying that, or he's being an atheist or an agnostic or whatever with these movies. But it's fascinating that sandwiched in between Prometheus and Alien Covenant is Exodus, Gods and Kings. And The Counselor as well is quite a godless film. It's about a universe in which bad shit will happen because there is no God, there is no righteousness, there is no justice. And that's quite a cynical, quite a nihilistic worldview, juxtaposed with joyfulness of The Martian, and even All the Money in the World has quite an optimistic resolution, I would say.
Well, I think, although you pointed out Exodus, Gods and Kings, but that's quite interesting because that's almost, it's obviously not an atheistic take on what happened because supernatural stuff happens, but it doesn't spell it out massively, and it rationalizes mm-hmm. the plagues in a way that is the one good idea. I mean, you know, I said that there was one good idea in it.
That was
the one good idea. The way it rationalizes the plagues, which is really interesting. So it's not just kind of random magic stuff plucked out of the sky or whatever. So, but I mean, you know, I am not a Christian. I am an atheist. I kind of took the theism, if you like, in Gods and Kings in the same way I took the theism in Noah. It's a mythology. You're playing with a mythology, and you know, Christian Jewish mythology is as valid as any other mythology that we get on a cinema screen. But I couldn't, in terms of the godlessness and the atheism of the Alien films, I just couldn't get past how bad they were. I couldn't get any deeper. It was just such bad storytelling. I couldn't even start messing around with the themes in my head.
Well, there's always been a running theme about the senselessness of violence. I think going right back to The Duelists, which is just about these two guys just fighting for no reason.
It's just male ego, isn't it, that film?
Yeah,
it's
fascinating. Which is what you get in Kingdom of Heaven as well, where you've got these two sides and they're driven by the extremists on either side, and none of it really makes any sense. But I think that's a thing that he's had all throughout his career. It's just how pointless all this stuff is.
Kingdom of Heaven's an interesting one, though, because it's a 2.5 hour film, and then the director's cut, which is nearly 3 hours 20. So that's a monstrosity. The director's cut being a substantially different film to the theatrical one, and vastly superior. It's fascinating. So his whole thing on that was that he listened to focus groups too much. The early test screenings were quite negative, so he cut 45 minutes out of the film to, in inverted commas, improve it, and ended up killing the whole film. And he's kind of railed against the test screenings ever since then, I think. But I genuinely love Kingdom of Heaven. Didn't like it at all when I first saw it. Revisited it for the director's cut, and suddenly it all fell into place because you have all that extra characterization. You understand who Balian is. You have all the prologue, the stuff with his brother, with Liam Neeson. The whole thing feels complete.
It's meaty and weighty.
Yeah, it feels like such a sort of diet film. It's just weird to say for a film that's 2.5 hours long. But like the love section doesn't make any sense.
Eva Green storyline is at all butchered.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing to it. It just feels like she's parachuted in for a sex scene and then leaves.
Yeah.
It's a very peculiar film. And then I think it definitely needed that breathing room. So if you haven't seen the director's cut, watch it, because it's great.
Just before he kind of catches the CGI bug, like many directors have. And I think if you look at Exodus after watching Kingdom of Heaven, like, one feels really weighty.
Although there is a scene in Kingdom of Heaven where they breach the walls, and there's an aerial view of the camera where you see top down on the battle and it pulls up. And I don't know how many takes they did or how hot it was or how late it was in the day, but all of the extras are just sort of shuffling and like pushing each other gently and just sort of like elbowing, and there's no fighting going on whatsoever. It looks like they're just like, it looks like they're all at a gig together. And it's in between the warm-up and the main act coming up, and they're all just sort of waiting, looking at the stage and having a boogie to the ambience music.
I think you'll find that it's historically accurate boogieing. But yeah, it's decent. A lot of people rave about Kingdom of Heaven director's cut. I can't quite see it. I haven't seen it on the big screen. I don't think did it ever get released on the big screen?
I think I saw it on the big screen.
No, it went, unless they did DVD screens, but I don't think it got a theatrical release.
I think it did.
But I was sure that wasn't a press thing, because we might have been shown it theatrically.
Maybe, but I definitely remember seeing it and going, oh wow, this is, honestly, for me, the word masterpiece is bandied around, but I think it's absolutely phenomenal. People lost their shit over Gladiator. It's a film I like. It's not amazing. That's got some pretty ropey CG in there as well. And this, for me, Kingdom of Heaven is a film Gladiator. I know that feels a little bit like the band the Beatles could have been, but it does it does feel like that.
What's your beef with Gladiator?
I don't have a huge beef with Gladiator. It's on my top 10, but again, largely because it's not White Squall.
Yeah, I'd say one of the what Gladiator has in its favour and Kingdom of Heaven doesn't is a great central performance.
Yes.
And I think you watch Kingdom of Heaven and it's very hard to get swept up in it, because Orlando Bloom, I like him a lot. He seems like a lovely guy, but I wouldn't, as the central character in a 3.5 hour historical epic.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the things about the director's cut, in that it gives other characters more room to shine. And it even makes his performance work a little bit better in context, when you get a little bit more depth and a little bit more understanding of who he is and where he comes from. But you're absolutely right. Russell Crowe. Welcome to a new world of gods and monsters. Russell Crowe, yeah, he's great in Gladiator. And did he win the Oscar for that? Or was it for Beautiful Mind that he won? It was for Beautiful Mind, wasn't it?
Yeah. But that's what established him as a really charismatic leading man. Like, you know, we knew him from LA Confidential and, you know, whatever else. Was it Romper Stomper?
Quick and the Dead, my friend.
Yes, Quick and the Dead.
Quick and the Motherfucking Dead.
But that kind of made him a star. And that was the film where, when he was making that film, I went clubbing with him in Covent Garden.
Sorry, what?
I went clubbing with Russell Crowe while he was shooting Gladiator. This is absolutely true.
You went clubbing?
Yeah, I know. That's the most unbelievable part of this story.
Was this before or after you were on set of Alien?
It was after I was on set of Alien. Right. We went, a friend of mine was friends with Ridley Scott's assistant and his assistant Millie, and we went to a club. And if memory serves, it was a club called The Funking Pussy.
Amazing.
And it was in Covent Garden. And Russell came and he wore a long coat and he just stood in the corner looking moody the entire evening.
Did you?
Which is normally my move in a club. So I was a little bit taken aback by
that. Did you have the tiger from Gladiator with you?
No, it didn't come. I think it was invited but couldn't make it.
Right, okay.
Can I say something about Gladiator and the CG thing?
Yeah.
Right. Gladiator was ahead of the curve, uh-huh. right, in that sense. Gladiator was the film that proved that you could resurrect the past in a big way using CGI.
Yes.
Yeah, before then, it's because like historical epics had gone out the window because they were just too expensive to mount. You couldn't do it, you know, apart from anything else. You can get the studio space anymore. You can get all the extras. And what Gladiator did was actually, it changed that. It started a whole, like, look in the sort of, during the 2000s, you suddenly got lots of people trying to do big historical epics again and bringing back, you know.
And then Kingdom Heaven killed it all.
Yeah, well.
Just
yeah,
4 years
yeah.
later.
So I think it's a bit unfair. I mean, it was by modern standards, some of it doesn't stand up so well. But just at the time, you know, people were gobsmacked, and rightly so. We hadn't seen, you know, ancient Rome presented that way.
And the music.
Yeah, music.
Oh, yeah,
great.
Zimmer and Gerard.
That's right.
Yeah, amazing
Gerard!
Stuff.
And of course, the whole film, I mean, because Oliver Reed died during production, obviously the ending of the film isn't what it was. It isn't what it was supposed to be.
Well, so. There's another reason the ending isn't what it was. It was supposed to be a huge battle scene. But they didn't have the money. they actually, so that's why you've got this promise of a big battle towards the end, and it's like, oh, no, actually, let's do this another way. They had to creatively solve that little problem.
But I like that film as well. I do like that film, and I like the fact that it kicked off this run of movies that Ridley made with Rusty Crowe. So over the next few years, they would make A Good Year, which wasn't great, American Gangster, Body of Lies, and Robin Hood. And that was it. That was the last time they worked together. So they need to get back on it, I think.
Robin Hood has a director's cut as well, doesn't it?
Does it?
I think so. I haven't seen
Surely
it.
Surely no one has watched that. That film was... When did that come out? 2010?
Robin Hood was 2010, yes.
That is correct.
I can remember nothing about that film.
I remember Mark Strong. That's it.
I liked it.
Did he have hair? He has hair in Body of Lies.
I don't think he had any.
He doesn't have hair now. No. Also, Oscar Isaac, early performance from Oscar
really?
Isaac.
Really? As who?
He's the best thing in it.
Yeah, he's
King
the,
John.
Yeah.
Was he? I don't remember that at all.
Cate Blanchett is Maid Marian.
She is, yes.
I have no recollection of this film either.
I liked Robin Hood.
It was based on a spec script, which I believe was posited that Robin Hood was actually the bad guy and the Sheriff of Nottingham was the good guy.
That's right.
And then Ridley Scott took over and ditched all of that and made a really basic, tedious origin story about Robin Hood that no one needs.
Wasn't that when it was called Nottingham?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
They took the same script and fiddled around with it.
That is more interesting than what it ended up being. And I'm not saying that what happened wasn't flawed. I mean, you've got the roving accent for a start. And maybe Crowe wasn't the best casting, considering that when he made that, he was older than Sean Connery was when they made Robin and Marian, which was supposed to be the film about the old age of Robin Hood.
But Sean Connery, in fairness, always looked like he was in his late 50s,
yeah,
apart from
the
early Bond stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It was kind of like the Batman Begins of Robin Hood. That's what I liked about it. It was just like saying, right, you have an idea and you end it with the idea of he's in the Sherwood Forest, there's the Merry Men, Maid Marian's part of the story, and the Sheriff of Nottingham's going, oh, that Robin Hood, I want to get him, except with a better voice. And it ends there. And I liked that. I kind of liked the fact that it kind of just built up and it had this really interesting idea of what?
It's just one of those movies that sets up its own sequel and just doesn't follow through on
it. No, it's kind of the story behind the legend.
That's the tagline,
like
Dan, isn't it?
Well, you're just
parroting the tagline.
I talk in taglines. What can I say?
The
and I kind of it was really interesting. There was some interesting stuff. And I thought King John was fantastic. I thought Oscar Isaac was the best reason to see that film.
I mean, it's still quite drab and gloomy looking, as I recall. As we've established, I can't remember anything about it. But I remember it not looking particularly good. For a Ridley Scott film, you know, I don't know what I was expecting, some great trees or whatever, but... I think that's the one on his list that I just don't... And Exodus, those two, I don't think you could pay me to watch those again.
Really? I'd watch Robin Hood again, definitely. I absolutely would never watch Exodus again. No. Or The Counselor, to be honest.
couldn't pay me.
Counselor,
for
I would
for
watch
for different reasons.
The Counselor, I'd watch again because it's got enough good performance, enough interesting offbeat weird moments to draw you in. If you caught it on TV one day, but Exodus: Gods and Kings, no, that's a hard pass. Hard pass. In fact, for me, I mean, I don't like either Prometheus or Alien Covenant, but for me, that might be the worst of Sir Ritter's. But we're not here to talk about the worst necessarily. We're here to talk about the best. We're here to rank his top 10 ultimately. So that's nailed down some really hardline questions. What's your favorite Ritter's movie?
Well,
it's Alien, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Alien. I mean, you could probably tell from the story I told, the long story I told at the beginning. It's totally Alien.
Alien.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everyone
it's
else?
Alien. It's Alien. Yeah. It's absolutely Alien. Okay. I mean, you could make an argument for Blade Runner, but you'd be wrong because it's Alien.
I think his movies are generally quite sprawling, and I think he sometimes loses control of them because of that. And Alien, the fact it's set in such a claustrophobic, tight space for the most part, I think really helps it. And there's a sort of discipline, a disciplineness about it. That's not a word.
Oh, just a discipline.
A discipline about it, yeah. Which is not there in all of his movies. And I think it's amazing. It's pretty
good. Have you ever heard this, guys? I've just come up with this about Alien. This to me, it's a haunted house movie in space. Have you ever?
No one has ever
thought about that.
No one has ever thought about that before. No? That's quite revolutionary.
That's how it feels to me.
It's Jaws on a spaceship.
it's Grease, but in no wait no.
It's Black Rain, but in space.
To be fair,
it's Alien Covenant, but not shit.
I think to overlook his achievement in making that film work would be a crime, in that it is, in essence...
I mean, it was a film called Star Beast, initially.
Yes, exactly.
It was a schlocky and B-movie as you could possibly get.
It's a better title.
It's the kind of stuff we all rented that went straight to video in the 80s, and yet he turned it into something that has endured the test of time.
To think we could have a movie called Star Beast Covenant. it's such a shame they changed the title. Star Beasts...
Well, to be fair to Starbeast, I mean, you know, Dan O'Bannon, and he did Dark Star with John Carpenter, which is another one of my favourites.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And Return of the Living Dead, which is a great zombie film
indeed.
As well.
Indeed. So
but it all comes together. The score is amazing. The Geiger star. It's just one of those movies where everything came together.
Everything.
But obviously, he's a huge part of it. And,
But it's dripping with tension, that film is. It's absolutely terrifying. I mean, I would say in terms of the scariest films I've ever seen, that and The Omen are probably the two which have caused me to run screaming from the room.
But going back to Alien real quick, he also pulls that trick, doesn't he, of, you know, nowadays you go into it knowing Sigourney Weaver's the star because of Aliens. And maybe we all knew that going into when we saw it for the first time. But back in the day...
My mum explained it all to me. I told you this.
Yeah.
I knew everything.
But was this pre-Aliens or post-Aliens?
Pre-Aliens.
Aliens
was 86, so
all right.
Yeah. This,
okay.
Hang on. Oh, no, let me do the maths. Hang on, everyone be quiet while I do the maths.
Oh, Jesus.
No, it was pre-Aliens.
All right.
Brief pause while Dan does maths.
But if you went to see that film in 1979, you had no idea. You thought that Tom Skerritt was going to be the guy because he's the big name.
He's Skerritt, come on.
Imagine, yes. No
he's
one's
the man.
No one's going to kill Skerritt. Skerritt's going to survive. But you know that he's, you know, that you think that Skerritt's going to be the big boy on campus. Even someone like John Hurt, who the film focuses on for the first, you know, 10, 15 endless minutes. And then obviously Sigourney Weaver comes to the fore.
Also,
that's relatively fresh.
What's quite interesting is up until that point, Sigourney Weaver's character is a bit of a bell end. Like, she's not particularly likable. The scene she has, you know, with Parker and Brett, she comes across as an arse. When she won't let them back into the ship, she comes across as incredibly cold and unfeeling. Like, you don't like her very much.
She's the smart. She's unlike in Prometheus and Alien Covenant, where every character makes very stupid choices and doesn't behave in any realistic way. She is making very intelligent choices, the kind of things that most rational people would do in those situations, and behaves in completely believable ways.
True.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So she's, you say she comes across as a bit of a, what was the word you used?
Bell end.
but actually she's the person that's following the protocols, which they should, you know. You don't just get off a spaceship, walk onto a planet's surface, take your helmet off. Yep. I mean, it might be breathable air, but there might be some other things there that you've got something to worry about. Everybody in Alien Covenant.
One thing that this film has that the other Alien films doesn't is that real sense of the crew being this blue-collar, working-class kind of unit. And they're like space truckers.
Yeah.
Which I think, I wonder if partly that's due to Ridley's, you know, he was brought up in the north of England, in County Durham, I think. And
yeah.
I just wonder how much of he brought to that sense of these guys as just being...
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's a working class background, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want you all to be like truckers in space.
Oh, God.
Can you do that? And then when the man is like having his dinner and like sort of rip out of his chest, like, and there'll be blood everywhere, and you'd be like, what the fuck is going on, man? That's what. That's how Ridley directed it, feels, back in the late 70s.
It just feels different to other sci-fi films and, you know, look at like Star Trek. It's just a very different vibe with the characters. Like, I'm just saying, don't overlook the characters.
No, I agree. Mm. I agree. Right, so Harrison, you're a replicant. So you're like a robot, but you've got programming. How are you super strong? That's what he's thinking. Just very quickly then. Okay, a couple of very, very quick questions. We've got in the top 10. Number one, is Descartes a replicant? Yes or no? Go, quickly around the table.
No.
Dan says no.
Yes.
Nick says yes. James?
Yes.
James says yes. I say no.
Oh, stalemate.
We'll have to take this one to the Morrison's car park.
It's because you're programmed to do that.
Yes. Cells interlinked. Interlinky cells. My cells are interlinked. Second thing, what is the film on your list that might surprise people?
Black Rain.
You've given it a round kick in here, but it's still on your list.
It's objectively not a good film. However, it is better than Rising Sun, and it has the most glamorously shot car park in cinematic history. So for that reason, I'm putting it in at number 10.
And we've talked about it, but that scene where Andy Garcia gets his head chopped off is a really good scene.
It's a really good scene. So spoiler, yeah. Andy Garcia gets his head chopped off by some Yakuza bikers.
Yeah.
Who are, ooh, they're rotters.
Yeah.
But Michael Douglas is on the other side of this this sort of chain link fence, and you can see everything happening, but he can't get to him. It's just really well shot. It's a great death scene.
Not the most progressive of film in terms of race relations.
No. Yeah, it's got Michael Douglas using words that he shouldn't be using about his Japanese compadres, and every Japanese character is either a villain or incompetent. I'm giving it a place on my list because of the neon. How much neon there
is. He loves the neon. Dan, what's on your list that might surprise people?
Well, it's Robin Hood.
Robin Hood?
Yeah.
And you've told us why?
Yeah.
Don't tell us a number. Don't tell us a number. We'll do it in a second. James, what's on your list that might surprise people?
Prometheus.
You.
All right, hang on. We can't drop that as we're coming to the end of the podcast because that's going to fuel another 45 minutes of me calling you a bellend.
No, I told you. I have a real soft spot for Prometheus when taken as a standalone, sort of very traditional hard sci-fi experience. The visuals are incredible. I loved the world of it. I remember coming out of the screening of that and arguing with everyone because I'd really liked it and you all hated it.
I saw
it at the IMAX, as I remember. And I was the lone voice of reason.
I like it until everyone starts behaving really, really stupidly. Just like they do in Alien Covenant as well. Mm. It's a good film for the first 45 minutes and then everyone forgets how to behave.
I work at Empire. I have a high tolerance for stupidity.
That bit where the alien comes and the snakey things and he's, hello girl, oh you're beautiful, oh yeah. I mean, everyone's been terrified up until this point and all of a sudden he's all like, oh look, you know, oh it's lovely, look at it.
Yeah, you wouldn't behave like that, would you, Sean Harris? No. I love rocks. Ritter's on set directing Rafe's ball. Right, Ralph, what's going to happen is, like, you're going on set now and there's, like, a massive snake and you go towards the snake and the snake's going to bite you. But don't worry about it, it's going to be all right. It's going to grab your arm.
It's going to be all right.
This is spot on, Sir Ridley.
This was your day on set. That's what you observed.
I've observed you, Ridley.
Go over there. Big snake.
There's a reason it was the last Ridley script. The film he was ever on the set on.
I started directing.
Were you actually... Yeah. That explains everything. You were actually pretending to be
I
him.
I grabbed hold of the microphone. Right, Charlie's lass, if you just run, and then the thing are going to crush you. I'd like to run to the side. No, lass, that's not how you do it up in Newcastle. You just run straight. And then you get crushed by the massive thing. Anyway.
That's almost certainly what happened.
That's almost, yeah. And then very, very last thing, what's your favourite Ridley Scott scene? And you cannot say the chest burster.
Ooh.
Ha ha! Nick coughs gently into a microphone, buying time. I don't have an answer for this, but I don't know what you think.
I mean, the obvious choice would be Roy Batty's death in Blade Runner, so I'm not going to choose that, although it is fantastic.
No, choose it. I
really like Brett's death in Alien, which is obviously the first proper death other than John Hurt's.
Yeah.
And just when he walks in where there's all the water, which is weirdly, it's raining in a spaceship, but it's the water coming down from the condensation from the air conditioning thing.
We know full well. Yeah. Look at those pipes
much the same as this in the Empire office. And just, you know, he's looking for the cat. Where are you, stupid cat? You know, and it comes down. You don't see enough of it. You see enough to be terrified, but not enough to know what it is and just that it's grown. And that's an incredibly tense moment. I would argue that is the standout moment from that film?
First big fight in the gladiatorial arena in Gladiator, where they're supposed to be killed. They're supposed to lose because they're faking a battle.
Yeah.
And Maximus is like, well, I'm no normal gladiator, am I? I'm Maximus. I'm a general. So he mobilizes them all, and it just turns into... And it's great because it's a great battle scene, but also it's a battle scene which in itself is designed to be entertaining, because by this point he's learned that to be a good gladiator, you've got to put on a show. So it kind of works in a double way. And that, honestly, just makes my spine tingle every time I see it.
And then it ends with a confrontation, doesn't it? You'll remove your helmet and tell me your name.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome stuff. Nick?
Not counting Black Rain.
Yeah.
And not counting the Lord of the Rings joke in The Martian.
Good Sean joke. Bean.
I'm going to pick the Voight-Kampff test in Blade Runner. Just because it's such a great intro. Mm. It feels really noir-y. It's beautifully lit. It's got creepy questions about insects turtles. And turtles. It's just an amazing scene.
Fantastic. Good choices all. I'm going to go for the chest buster scene from Alien, which is just phenomenal and unsurpassed in the annals of cinema history. Right. Okay. Enough squabbling. Let's vote. Okay. So what we're going to do now is you're going to submit your top 10s to me. I've got my top 10 as well. I'm going to assign points to 10 points to number 1, 1 point to number 10. Work it all out. Then we're going to come back and we're going to discuss the top 10. All right. Got cool. that?
All right.
Okay.
I'm changing my list on the fly.
Really?
You can't.
You can't do that.
I can't. I'm taking out the Duelist and replacing it with Black Hawk Down.
Oh. Massive bellend.
Doesn't matter. Come on, just.
No, it matters.
No, it doesn't. It
does. Enough squabbling. Let's vote.
Okay, welcome back. We have totted up all the points and we have the official Empire Top 10 of Sir Ridley Scott's films. You excited?
Very.
You ready?
Especially to find out where Black Rain is.
Black Rain, sadly, is at number 11. It's not. It was because only one person voted for it, and that was only at number 10. So it only got 1 point. So it didn't make it into the top 10, sadly. Neither did Hannibal. I gave Hannibal a nice little 1 point vote. So it didn't quite make it in. So shame. Also, just outside the top 10, Robin Hood and Prometheus.
Prometheus was robbed.
Oh, and The Duelists. The Duelists dropped it down because of a last-minute change of heart by James Dyer.
I had to parachute in Black Hawk Down, if only because I saw it at a screening while sitting in the row in front of Ridley Scott, and my phone went off halfway through, and he was unhappy.
Wow, your interaction with Ridley Scott and Ridley Scott stars throughout your career is kind of amazing.
It's been a formative role in my life.
Was he going, who's got a bloody phone on? Yeah. Turn that bloody phone off or shove it up your ass. Right.
Literally what he said.
Number 10, All the Money in the World. Last year's most recent Ridley Scott film. What do we reckon about that?
Decent with great performances.
Yeah, Wahlberg. Well, great performance. Two great performances. I don't want to single out Mark Wahlberg, but I'm going to single out Mark Wahlberg.
He's amazing.
And his amazing intellectual glasses that he dons at moments throughout the film to make himself look clever. Yeah. Christopher Plummer in particular is terrific, given he shot it in like 20 minutes.
Good solid film. Nice thriller. Works well for me. Good visuals. Dan hasn't seen it. Dan, if you'd seen it, might have gone further up the list.
It might have done.
It might have pushed up a couple of places. But All the Money in the World, I'm totally fine with that. It's fine. And in comparison to Alien Covenant, it is a bloody masterpiece. At number 9, sneaking in at the very last minute, it is Leave No Man Behind, Black Hawk Down.
Yes, indeed.
A film we didn't talk about in the main bulk of the podcast.
We didn't, did we?
Now, Black Hawk Down is really interesting because it's kind of plot-free, in a way. It's just a presentation. Plot-free?
Plot-free.
Yeah, it is Scott-free. It's plot-free, Scott-free.
It's both plot-free and Scott-free.
Yes. And it's really visceral and immersive. I have some issues with it. Mm. But in some way, it's got similarities to Dunkirk in some ways. It kind of just drops you straight in. There's a little bit of a preamble to explain things for you, but not that much.
Hell of a cast.
Very proper ensemble as well. Yeah. Was it Josh Hartnett?
He was the one who got his name above the title, which I think showed where his star was at that time.
Eric Banner.
Was on the poster.
Yeah.
Eric Banner is the best thing in the movie by
the best
mile.
Ever Hulk. No, not really.
Bill Fichtner.
Orlando's in there, isn't he?
He is in there.
Al Bloomster.
Yeah. Ewan McGregor.
And Bremner.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you got to have Bremner. If you got McGregor, it came as a 2-for-1 package deal back in the day. Jason Isaacs.
Jason Isaacs, yes.
Yeah. He's in there.
Yep. Who else? Ron, what's his face off ER? He
Ron
was the pilot.
Ron Livingston.
Ron Eldard. Yes.
Jeremy Piven, the Piv,
Piven.
Yeah.
I forgot Piven was in it.
Yeah, the Piv. Honestly, it's a really good, solid war film. Bruckheimer produced. And it's got a great sequence, hasn't it? Where they're operating on this guy and they're trying to... He's bleeding profusely from thigh wound. It's one of the most grisly things I've ever seen. It's absolutely horrible. All right.
Is it a controversial view to say I prefer 13 Hours? I'm saying it anyway.
Yeah. Nick is Mr. Controversy. Number 8, Legend.
Yes.
It is Legend.
Yeah.
Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah.
All right.
I'd say 5 stars for Tim Curry and his character design, yeah, and specifically his giant horny horns.
And another 5 stars,
2 stars
the
for everything else. So that brings me to 3 stars.
Brilliant goblins.
Mm. Brilliant goblins.
Brilliant goblins.
Tom Cruise has excellent hair when he's, what, 15 or whatever he is, isn't that?
Yeah. And the look of it as well, the kind of all the fairy dust in the air.
It's
everything.
Very
it's all
earnest,
like,
and twee.
Mm. You're earnest and twee.
Earnest and twee, it's like a double act.
Number 7, Matchstick Men.
Well, I really like this one.
I like this one.
It's a caper. It's his only caper. Ridley's only caper. Very, very good twist. I hope I haven't ruined the film for anyone by saying there's a twist.
You have. There's a twist, yeah.
Good, but it's a good, it's a sort of Sting-esque con men.
Message in a bottle. Or a different Sting, okay.
Alison Lohman's very good in that.
Yeah, she is.
A double act with Nick Cage and Sam Rockwell.
Mm. Yeah.
That's a good double act.
And it's funny as well.
It is fun. Mm.
And also one of the best sort of mid-era Cage performances, I would say, as well. He's really, really solid.
He's got Tourette's in it. And at points, he over-cages. But,
you can't over-cage.
You can't over-cage.
By definition.
You can never get too much Cage.
No, it's impossible to over-cage. And who can forget Fran Kranz from Cabin in the Woods as Slacker Boyfriend? Right, number 6, Gladiator.
Are you not entertained?
Evidently not.
6, that's lower than I thought.
That
it would
is
be.
Lower than I thought as well. That is a shame.
That was my number 3.
I think I contributed to its downfall there.
Literally, it was terrible.
It was number 9, just ahead of Black Rain by one point. I struggle to like this film. I would like to enjoy it as much as everyone else seems to. I enjoy the bit with the tiger. I think there's a good rhino bit. I enjoy the animals, basically.
There's no rhino
there's no
bit.
There's no rhino in it. You're thinking of Black Panther.
Okay, well, there should be a rhino. It would be much higher on my list had there been a rhino. It's fine, but, you know, Spartacus did it better.
Oh, my God. I love it. I love the performance. I love the film. I love the music. I like the spectacle. I absolutely adore that film. Weirdly, the one thing I don't like is Joaquin Phoenix, who was nominated for his performance in that, and I think he's terrible.
I'm terribly vexed.
I'm terribly, terribly vexed.
Terribly, just terribly vexed.
Dreadful.
He sticks his tongue out a lot.
Yeah, and I don't understand why he got fated for that, because, shit.
He should have been replaced by a rhino. That would have improved the film immeasurably.
Rhino from Gladiators.
Yes.
Was there a phoenix in Gladiators?
There should have been. There was a jet.
There was a wolf. Yeah, just one of the animals from Gladiators.
All right, hang on a second. I know we're doing a top 10 countdown here, but I have to see whether there was a phoenix in Gladiators. Oh, God, I spelled phoenix wrong. Phoenix Gladiators. Right. There was... There was a phoenix in Gladiators. So
okay.
There you go.
Wow. Was there a crow in Gladiators?
No.
It's possible we've become sidetracked.
Number 5. And this is the big shock. Because I think the top 5 is pretty much as you would expect, except for this. Kingdom of Heaven, pipping Gladiator by a single point.
That is insanity.
I don't know. I don't think it's as good. But I do think the director's cut is an extraordinarily good film. So
Hand up. I haven't seen the director's cut.
I think, oh yeah, but they are very different.
I kind of get a bit tired of the whole director's cut thing with Ridley Scott. It's like, if you couldn't get it right first time, mate, why should I bother? Right? Other directors have to work hard and get it right first time. You keep going, oh, like, why are you with that? I'm going to do it again.
Would you say that to his face? In those words. Get it right the first time, mate. Don't waste my time.
If I had a few inside me, drinks, then I would. But if I was being sober and professional... Of course it wouldn't, no.
I think you need a helicopter of soldiers to come save you.
I think you would. Leave no Dan behind.
No, it's like Terry Gilliam once said to me, why should Ridley get 2 bites of the apple when no one else does?
Well, clunk. I mean,
can open worms everywhere.
I'm happy that it's at number 5.
You're just happy there's number 5. I'm happy we got here.
I'm just happy to be here, Chris.
I'm just happy there's a 5. Number 4, The Martian.
Oh yeah, good. I wouldn't have put it.
I would
high.
Take Kingdom of Heaven over The Martian every day of the week, but sure.
Is it his most crowd pleasing film?
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's just it's quite unlike him in terms of its entertainment factor, and as you said earlier, his films are quite somber and serious, and it's good just to watch him letting his beard hair down.
The space pirate gag made me giggle.
Yeah,
I likely enjoyed the film. I don't think it was masterful. It comes from a very workmanlike book, so he did a very good job.
Book's awful.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a great adaptation, but it's not.
He made potatoes out of shit.
He did. Say. Indeed, make potatoes. Oh,
it does annoy me though that they treat disco as bad music in that film, when everyone knows disco is the best music of all kinds of music.
Disco
that,
is not dead. Disco is life.
Yes, that is the biggest problem with the film, Dan.
Interesting Martian fact. It is his biggest hit by some distance, pipping Gladiator into second place and Hannibal into third. Hannibal is his third biggest film. Alien, of course, if you adjust for inflation, I imagine is going to be up there as well. Blade Runner, as we know, was a big old flopperoony.
So they're bound to do a sequel to The Martian at some point, where either Matt Damon gets stuck on a different planet, or
the Venusian.
Sean Bean gets stuck on Mars, or
couldn't be stuck on Venus, Dan. He would die instantly.
What? No, he wouldn't. He'd just go into the forest.
Oh, no, Chris. Men are from Mars. Women are from Venus.
Number three, Thelma and Louise.
Yes.
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 Yep. Okay.
Yes.
Number
yes,
two.
Please.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, totally. That is absolutely 100% Ridley Scott's third best film.
Who's your favourite, Thelma or Louise?
Thelma.
Thelma.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like her journey. She's got the biggest journey, I think.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah. Off the end of a cliff, ultimately.
No, I was talking character arc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Her arc. Yeah. Falling off the edge of a cliff. Gravity takes over.
It does.
Never does. Gravity never takes over.
No, but it will.
But how do you know? The moment is frozen.
All right. Because I'm sure people have done this thing where they go the distance of the canyon. Is it the Grand Canyon or is it just a canyon? Anyway, the distance of the canyon, the between cliff and cliff, and then the speed of the car. There's no way you could possibly do that.
Maybe there's a giant bouncy castle at the bottom.
Like a children's party. This car suddenly flies out of nowhere.
Disrespectful.
Moving on to number two.
Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there is no arguing about this. Chris, you feel you fully understand the film at this point? Or do
no,
you need to
I
do
don't.
Could you Dan-splain it to Chris?
Well, we're assuming here that we are talking about either the director or the final cut, right? We're not talking about the theatrical version.
This final cut.
Yeah, yeah. So three bites of the apple with this film.
Yeah.
But he got there in the end, didn't he?
He did, just about. I've seen it a number of times to try and get the appreciation of it that you guys have as well. And I just don't... Blade's not even fucking in it, so... I don't understand.
But even without following the story, the soundtrack for this film is reason enough to love it. I think even if it wasn't a great film, I would just love listening to it.
I will say, if you are going to watch Blade Runner, I can heartily recommend the 4K Blu-ray, which was released. It's been remastered for 4K. The scan is incredible. It looks amazing in 4K and has an Atmos soundtrack, which is really, really good.
Is that available in all stores
near you? This is not a plug. I'm just saying, if you are, it is one of the reference 4K Blu-rays. Like, it's one of the best you can get.
And James will be selling those outside.
I'll be selling them out of a suitcase at the back of the office.
Yeah. Car boot sale this Sunday.
I'm just saying, for a film that old, you know, it holds up really well. So,
but isn't the central problem with Blade Runner is that Harrison Ford's performance is just a bit somnambulistic and just a little bit...
Not at all.
It's perfect.
No,
it would have been the scene where he sort of pretends to be the
nerdy
journalist.
Guy.
Is it journalist? Yeah. Sorry, I've gone out of my head.
Inspector. Isn't it inspector? He's pretending to be inspector.
Oh, yeah, that's it. The inspector, yeah. The snake inspector.
The snake inspector.
Yeah, which is almost as good as the scene. When he pretends to be a Scottish tourist in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
But, oh, that's such a good line.
Yeah.
He's terrible at disguises, isn't he? Mm. But no, it's a great performance. What are you talking about?
All right, number one. And this is the first time. We've only been doing the ranking for a few issues now. But this is the first time this has happened. All four of us chose the same film at number one. Number one with a bullet. 40 points out of a possible 40. It is, of course, White Squall. Bit shocked, I'll be honest. I thought Alien might have crashed the top 10. No, it's Alien. It's Alien.
Amazing. But it's still not as good as Aliens.
True. Very true. Incontrovertible.
So there's just... I'll just crap on that little...
No, absolutely true. Ridley Scott's best film is not as good as James Cameron's best film. That's what we've established.
Yep.
True Lies.
This didn't have to be tribalistic. We didn't have to go down that path. We'll have a James Cameron ranking one day, and then you can discuss your love of aliens then.
Yes.
Has he made 10 films?
Right, so anything else to say about Alien being number one?
What more is there to say? It's good. Go and watch it again.
Fantastic.
It is good.
Okay.
Well done, okay, Ridley. Okay. Are you saying Alien theatrical edition or Alien with the tiny little extra bits?
Theatrical.
I agree. Excellent. Moving on.
Same as Aliens, theatrical cast.
Yeah. Well, Aliens is a slightly different thing. Where Aliens, where there are a number of new sequences, all of which...
Oh, you mean things like Dallas, when she finds Dallas. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. But the Aliens ones, there's some good and some bad. So actually, you want a mixture of the two, I'm saying, for Aliens. Half theatrical, half special edition. Because you want the sentry guns.
Don't forget to listen to the director's cut of this podcast, which will be probably 95 hours long. And just
me breaking down Aliens scene by scene.
Yeah, all the Ridley Scott impressions that were cut out, the cut that you listened to first time around. Because that is it for this episode of The Ranking. I'd like to thank my fellow rankers, James Dyer.
Thanks.
Dan Jolin.
Are you still not entertained?
I think they've stopped listening, Dan, to be honest. Okay. And Nick Dissemblian.
Goodbye. This will all be lost like tears in the black rain.
I might go back and rewatch Black Rain now. You've really sold me. Should we do a Black Rain Hannibal double bill, anyone?
Let's not get caught, Chris. Let's keep going.
Don't forget, of course, the regular Empire podcast is every Friday. We do have specials as well, so do keep an eye on their Twitter feed and on, of course, your podcast app as well for loaves. In the meantime, I've been Chris Hewitt. This has been the Ranking Ridley Scott edition. Thanks very much for listening. Ridley, get out. Bloody hell. See you next time. Bye. Oh, Ridley. Back in the corner.